Welcome and hello, everyone. So glad you're joining us for another deep dive into a topic that touches all our lives. I'm Pat.
And I'm Jesse. Today, we're embarking on a truly fascinating journey, tracing the origins and, well, the evolution of something many of us have experienced or at least wondered about, psychotherapy.
That's right. When this stack of sources came across my desk, I knew this would be a compelling exploration. Our mission today is to unpack the rich, sometimes surprising history of mental health therapy.
Yeah.
You know, from ancient practices and early institutional responses right through to the cutting edge digital solutions available today. We're really going to look at how our understanding of the human mind and how we heal it has dramatically transformed over centuries.
Exactly. We'll see how the very approach of treatment has shifted, moving from ancient beliefs about like curses and possessions to modern evidence-based scientific approaches, and even into the dynamic digital realm. It's a story of evolving compassion, increasing scientific rigor, and ultimately why this entire journey matters to you, our listener, in understanding mental well-being today.
Okay, let's unpack this incredible history. So to kick us off, when did therapy as a concept really begin? It feels like humans have always tried to help each other, right?
That's a fantastic question, and you're spot on. Our sources tell us there isn't one single exact start date for therapy as a formal practice.
Okay.
Humans, by their very nature, have been offering each other support for centuries through talk, various wellness practices, even meditation. Practices that were therapeutic in nature were actually documented way back in ancient Greece.
But it wasn't always called psychotherapy, was it? And the ways people understood mental distress were, well, pretty different from our modern perspective.
Absolutely. Before the 1800s, mental health conditions were often interpreted through very different lenses, things like curses, demonic possessions, or what was broadly labeled as hysteria.
Hysteria, right.
Yeah, and it's truly sobering to learn that many women were treated for female hysteria until as late as the 1980s.
Wow, that late.
Yeah. Even more dramatically, individuals who deviated from societal norms were sometimes even considered witches. This history really highlights this significant stigma and profound misunderstanding that once existed around mental health.
It's a stark reminder, yeah.
It is. How deeply societal beliefs, rather than objective science, once shapes who was deemed sick and how they were treated.
Wow, witches. That's a stark contrast to today's understanding. So when did the term psychotherapy become an official part of our vocabulary?
Well, the official term psychotherapy itself actually emerged in the early 1800s, during the 19th century.
Okay.
This marked a really significant conceptual shift, even if the understanding of the mind was still very, nascent.
Sure.
Our sources also mention early influential movements from that era, such as the moral treatment movement. This was championed by figures like Philippe Pinel in France and the Tuques in England.
Ah, right. The moral treatment people.
Exactly. And it advocated for treating patients with dignity, respect, and providing humane, supportive environments rather than just confinement and, well, harsh methods.
And what about those early institutions for mental health, like the infamous Bedlam that we hear about?
Yes. The very first mental health institutions began opening around the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Bethlehem in London, which, as you said, became infamously known as Bedlam and Salpêtrière in Paris.
Right.
The treatments there were often incredibly harsh by today's standards. I think whirling chairs, tranquilizing chairs used for restraint, straitjackets.
Oh, my God.
And even practices like bleeding. These, though they sound barbaric to us, were often based on the limited medical understanding of the time, like ancient Greek theories of humors or attempts to sort of shock patients back to normalcy.
So the focus wasn't really on healing.
No, not at all. It was heavily on confinement and control rather than compassionate healing. A very different time.
It sounds like a difficult beginning, defined by misunderstanding and harshness. But this truly sets the stage for a major turning point, doesn't it? A revolution in how we conceived of mental health itself, led by one name that still resonates today.
Hmm.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When we think of the start of modern therapy, one name usually comes to mind, Sigmund Freud. What problem was he really trying to solve with his work, and what did he fundamentally bring to the table that was so revolutionary?
Well, Freud's work, beginning in the late 19th century, truly marked a seismic shift. The core problem he addressed was the sheer lack of an explanatory model for mental illness.
Right, there was no why.
Exactly. Before him, treatments were largely symptom-focused and lacked any underlying theoretical framework. He sought to understand the development and manifestation of psychological disorders to give us a why behind the what.
So it sounds like he wasn't just observing symptoms. He was trying to build a fundamental system of understanding, a new language for our inner lives. How radical was that shift at the time?
It was profoundly radical.
Yeah.
Yeah. His development of psychoanalysis, while not directly preceded by a single specific scientific breakthrough, was heavily influenced by advances in neurology and the work of figures like Jean-Martin Charcot,
okay,
who studied hysteria and hypnosis, and Joseph Breuer, who famously developed the talking cure with his patient Bertha Pappenheim, known as Anna O.
Talking cure, that's such an evocative term. It sounds so simple, yet it must have been absolutely revolutionary for the time.
It truly was. Freud expanded significantly on this, introducing pioneering techniques like free association, where patients just said whatever came to mind.
Right.
Dream interpretation to uncover unconscious desires, and the analysis of concepts like the id, representing our primal urges, the ego, our rational mediating self, and the superego, our internalized moral compass.
The id, ego, superego. Yeah, classic Freud.
Exactly. This work ultimately led to the development of psychodynamic therapy, which delves deep into both the unconscious and conscious aspects of the human mind. His first book, An Interpretation of Dreams, published in 1900, really brought his knowledge to mainstream society.
And from Freud, it seems like a whole tree of other psychological thought and theories grew, right? It wasn't just him.
Yes, absolutely. Many subsequent theorists, including Carl Jung, Alfred Adler, Karen Horney, and even his daughter, Anna Freud, built upon his fundamental ideas, though they often developed their own distinct systems and approaches.
Okay.
These were all later categorized under the umbrella of psychodynamic approaches. What's fascinating here is how this early, influential work, while groundbreaking for its time, was primarily based on clinical observation and theoretical speculation,
mm-hmm,
rather than broader, empirically scientific grounding. That distinction would become very important later on.
And our sources also remind us of a stark reality from that time. Psychotherapy was often religious, primarily Christian, and mostly available to wealthy white men and their families.
That's right.
This really raises an important question about accessibility and equity that we still grapple with today, doesn't it?
It definitely does. A crucial point. So, after Freud laid this foundational work, what happened next? How did therapy begin to broaden its scope and become more structured and, importantly, more scientific?
Yeah, moving beyond just theory.
Right. This next phase, roughly from the mid-20th century, saw significant formalization and diversification in the field. Before that, actually, in 1896, Leitner Whitmer opened the first psychological clinic.
Okay, a clinic.
Yeah, a crucial step that shifted the focus towards diagnosing conditions rather than just attributing them to supernatural causes.
Mm.
Academic milestones followed quickly. The first doctorate in psychology was awarded in 1886 to Joseph Jastrow.
Wow, back then.
And the American Psychological Association, APA, was founded in 1892. And it's worth noting that Margaret Washburn became the first woman to earn a PhD in psychology in 1894, marking an early step towards broader inclusion.
So the profession itself really started to solidify, and with that came more structured tools for diagnosis, I guess.
Precisely. The first Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, was published in 1952.
Ah, the DSM.
Yes. This was a monumental step, providing a standardized way to categorize and diagnose mental health conditions, moving away from purely subjective interpretations.
Hmm.
But beyond diagnosis, new approaches to treatment were also rapidly emerging, often directly driven by scientific advances and a desire for more empirical rigor.
And this is where we start seeing therapies focus less on unconscious drives and more on observable behaviors and cognitive patterns, things we could actually measure, sort of.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that while Freud's work remained foundational, there is a growing recognition that psychotherapeutic interventions needed more direct scientific grounding. This led to the development of what we call science-derived psychotherapies in the 1950s and 60s. We saw behavioral therapy emerge, with contributors like B.F. Skinner and Joseph Wolpe focusing specifically on how observable behaviors could be learned and unlearned.
Right. Behaviorism.
Simultaneously, cognitive therapies, from pioneers like Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis, began focusing on changing dysfunctional or unhelpful thought patterns.
And I remember from our sources that this is also where Carl Rogers and humanistic psychology fit in, offering another very influential perspective.
Yes, a hugely influential figure. In 1942, Carl Rogers introduced person-centered therapy. His 1961 book, On Becoming a Person, A Therapist's View of Psychotherapy became a seminal work.
Huge.
Rogers is considered one of the founders of humanistic psychology, which emphasized the inherent goodness of people, the importance of the therapeutic relationship, and the client's innate capacity for self-healing and growth.
So more focus on the person's potential.
Exactly. In person-centered therapy, the client takes the lead, and the therapist provides a supportive, non-judgmental environment, trusting the individual to resolve their own issues rather than offering direct solutions.
So this period really brought about a more humane, structured, and diverse approach to therapy, moving significantly away from past stigmas and towards a range of research-backed methods. A lot happened. A
huge amount, yeah.
So therapy is diversifying, becoming more established, and even more humane. But then came a powerful push for proving that these methods actually work effectively, right? Like, show us the data.
That's the next truly critical phase.
Yeah.
The era of evidence-based psychotherapy. Our sources highlight that by the 1970s, there was a clear demand for robust scientific knowledge demonstrating how and how well psychotherapy actually worked.
Okay.
Hans Eysenck's rather controversial 1952 paper, which challenged psychotherapy's overall effectiveness, really sparked this urgent need for more rigorous research.
Right, he sort of threw down the gauntlet.
He did, and that led to clinical trials becoming the gold standard for therapy, much like they were for medical treatments.
Yeah.
Precisely. Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, became the gold standard for evaluating therapeutic interventions. By the late 1970s, researchers even developed meta-analytic techniques.
Meta-analysis, oh.
Allowing them to statistically combine results from multiple studies, which provided much stronger evidence for therapy's effectiveness across various conditions. This period also led to a deeper look into the process of therapy itself.
What do you mean by process?
Well, investigating what specific elements actually make it effective, such as the therapeutic alliance, that collaborative bond between the client and therapist.
Ah, the relationship itself.
Exactly. Jerome Frank, a seminal contributor here, identified the common factors of psychotherapy's effectiveness, things that worked regardless of the specific technique being used.
Interesting. So it wasn't just the type of therapy.
Right. This sounds like a period of immense scientific growth and accountability, a real coming of age for the field. And this is also when we see the rise of what many people today think of as therapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT.
Yes, CBT. Everyone's heard of CBT.
Exactly.
Yeah.
CBT really solidified its position during this time, effectively combining cognitive and behavioral approaches in the 1970s. It focuses on helping you identify unhealthy beliefs and behaviors and then learn healthier coping skills and ways of thinking.
Practical stuff.
Very practical. It quickly became widely accepted as a primary, effective treatment for many disorders. And our sources note a typical course can be as short as 6 to 20 sessions, which is quite different from earlier, longer-term models.
Much shorter, yeah. And then, after CBT, what new insights or approaches define what people often call the third wave of these therapies?
That's right. These third-wave cognitive and behavioral therapies, which emerged in the 1990s and 2000s, like acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, and dialectical behavior therapy, DBT.
ACT and DBT, okay.
They expanded the scope even further by integrating principles like mindfulness, acceptance, and values-based living, offering a more holistic approach to complex issues. This entire period of standardization, from the 1980s to the mid-2000s, was all about ensuring therapeutic integrity and reproducibility, meaning that these therapies could be consistently taught, applied, and achieve reliable, predictable results across different clients and therapists, making it more of a science.
So a huge leap forward in making therapy reliable, measurable, and widely applicable. But even with all this standardization, there were still significant challenges, particularly around access for everyone who needed it, I imagine.
That's a key point. Absolutely.
So we've established psychotherapy as an increasingly evidence-based practice, grounded in science. But in the 21st century, the world changed rapidly with technology. How did that start to influence how we access mental health care?
This brings us to the most recent and rapidly evolving phases. The problem that became increasingly clear was a significant supply-demand mismatch for well-trained therapists.
Not enough therapists to go around.
Exactly. Our sources reveal a truly stark figure. As of December 2023, over half of the U.S. population, that's 169 million people, lives in a mental health professional shortage area. The need far outstripped the available help.
That's staggering. 169 million people. So technology stepped in to bridge that growing gap.
Exactly. The internet and, crucially, smartphones completely transformed daily life and, by extension, psychotherapy. From roughly 2005 to 2015, we saw the rapid rise of digital psychotherapy.
Okay.
Programs like Fear Fighter for Anxiety and Beating the Blues for Depression began offering structured CBT directly via computer platforms. We've moved from the initial apps like MyCompass and Headspace in 2010.
I remember Headspace starting up.
Yeah. To estimated 10,000 to 20,000 mental health apps available today.
10 to 20,000. That's an explosion of options. So it went from zero to there's an app for that.
Right.
And maybe an app for the anxiety of choosing an app.
Right.
But with so many options, how do you know what's actually effective and safe? It sounds a bit like the Wild West, as one of our sources put it.
It absolutely was. And, you know, to some extent, it still is. The rapid, largely unregulated growth of these apps led to significant concerns about quality, effectiveness, and, importantly, user safety.
Yeah, privacy too, I bet.
Huge privacy concerns. For instance, one review found that only about 29.6% of mental health apps met quality thresholds. Even more concerning, Mozilla found that 28 out of 32 popular mental health apps had significant data privacy issues.
Oh, wow.
Often lacking robust security measures and sometimes even selling user data to third parties.
Not good.
Not good at all. This widespread lack of oversight prompted a crucial next step, the development of prescription digital therapeutics, or PDTs, from about 2015 to the present.
Prescription digital therapeutics, PDTs. That sounds like software you get from a doctor, much like medication. Is that the general idea?
That's precisely the idea. The FDA recognized that standalone software could, in fact, function as a medical device, categorizing them as software as a medical device, or SAMD.
SAMD, okay.
This classification led to a formal regulatory process with key milestones like defining SAMD in 2013 and issuing guidance on mobile medical applications in 2014. Just recently, in March 2024, Rejoin became the first digital mental health app cleared by the FDA for adjunctive treatment of major depressive disorder.
The first one cleared for that?
Yeah, for MDD as an add-on treatment. And it combines CBT with cognitive training, which helps improve mental processes like attention, memory, and problem-solving skills.
This is a huge shift, not only for broader accessibility, but for the very future of mental health care itself. What does this development mean for how we'll approach mental well-being moving forward?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's all about ushering in an era of personalized and precision mental health care.
Personalized and precision.
Okay. The goal is to move far beyond one-size-fits-all treatments, leveraging data, your specific symptoms, and even your unique life story to find the best, most tailored way to help you. The future also points to a fascinating shift in neuroscience, moving beyond focusing just on brain chemicals or neurochemistry to understanding how brain circuits and connections or neurocircuitry work. This embraces the concept of brain plasticity, the brain's ability to change and adapt to develop non-pharmacological, non-invasive digital therapeutics, and even innovative combinations of drugs and digital interventions. It's about a multifaceted approach to healing.
It's truly incredible how far we've come from, you know, ancient beliefs and harsh, often misguided practices to these highly regulated, sophisticated digital therapies that are so tailored to the individual.
It's a massive evolution.
Wow, what an incredible journey through the history of psychotherapy. From ancient healing practices in the early, often harsh institutions,
yeah,
to Freud's groundbreaking psychoanalysis that gave us a new language for the mind, then the emergence of scientific evidence-based therapies like CBT and humanistic approaches, and now into the digital age with teletherapy and regulated prescription digital therapeutics.
Yeah.
It's truly a testament to humanity's ongoing quest to understand and heal the mind, constantly evolving.
Indeed. The evolution of psychotherapy reflects a continuous, often challenging effort to provide more specific, effective, and accessible interventions, constantly supported and shaped by advances in science and technology. The recognition of critical thinking and valuing multiple perspectives has been absolutely key to this progression, always aiming to reduce suffering and improve quality of life for individuals.
And looking ahead, it's clear we're on the cusp of even more personalized and integrated care, driven by innovation. So what does this all mean for you, our listener? It means mental health support is becoming more tailored, more accessible, and more scientifically grounded than ever before, truly moving into an exciting new era.
So as you reflect on this deep dive, consider this. How might these ongoing advancements continue to reshape our understanding of mental well-being and the role of therapy in our lives in the coming decades? What's next?
A truly thought-provoking question. Thank you for guiding us through this insightful deep dive.
My pleasure.
And thank you, our listener, for joining us. We hope you've gained some valuable insights and maybe even a few surprising facts today.
We certainly do. We really appreciate you spending your time with us.
Don't forget to like this deep dive, share it with someone you think would enjoy it, and leave us a comment with your thoughts or any questions this episode sparked for you. We love hearing from you.
Yeah, we do. And we hope you'll come back for our next deep dive.
Goodbye, everyone.